Call 877-288-1077.
Catholic Radio in Metro Detroit. This is 990 WDEO, Ypsilanti, Detroit, or on the internet at WDEO.net.
Hudson, welcome to Church and Culture. This show is devoted to exploring the interaction between our faith and our culture. Each week, I will talk with expert guests on topics ranging from literature, art, and music to politics, liturgy, spirituality, and education. Thank you for joining us. My pleasure today to have Dr. Stephen Baskerville on the show. He is professor of government at Patrick Henry College and research fellow at the Howard Center for Family, Religion, and Society, the Independent Institute, and elsewhere. He got his doctorate from the London School of Economics and has taught political science and international affairs at Howard University in Washington, D.C., and the Palecki University in the Czech Republic. He's written a lot of articles, a lot of reviews. His previous book is Taken into Custody, The War Against Fathers, Marriage, and the Family, but the book we're going to talk about today, which just came out, is entitled The New Politics of Sex, The Sexual Revolution, Civil Liberties, and the Growth of Governmental Power from Angelico. Stephen, welcome to Church and Culture.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Well, I've been living with your book all day, and I wrote an Amazon review before the show, and I'd like to read it to you and to our listeners. Professor Baskerville has written what well may be the most important book of 2017. He has written a masterly and authoritative account of how, quote, sexual radicalism has infected and transformed culture, politics, and the legal system. The entire narrative is supported by exhaustive research among scholars on both sides of the debate about the impact of feminism and homosexual activism on the entire criminal justice system, which Baskerville sees as creating an entire network of self-serving agents enforcing laws that ignore the presumption of innocence, due process, and public transparency. Baskerville also shows with jaw-dropping clarity how no-fault divorce laws have allowed the intrusion of federal and state government, in essence, into our private lives so much that privacy no longer exists. Single-parent families have been promoted by government intrusion and the Star Chamber demands of, quote, child support, which can so easily end up with the incarceration of fathers by ideologically driven family courts. Both the government and the divorce industry have a financial interest in the increasing growth of single-parent families and the removal of the father. Brilliant and compelling, The New Politics of Sex issues an urgent plea that we cut the Gordian knot of our radically sexualized culture and polity. That's the best I could do in a paragraph, Stephen.
Well, I want to thank you for those kind words. You seem to get it.
Well, I get it, and it's really a page-turner. Which is unusual for a book about policy and about, ideology. And I mean when I say that it may well be the most important book of 2017, because what you've done is you've pieced together all the parts of a huge and complicated problem. But we all know it does center around issues of sexuality and particularly the feminist account of them, which has now led to the homosexual and LGBT account of them, which has skewered the public mind. We no longer have a common sense about what sexuality is. We now are even considering points of view that allow for children to choose their gender. So with that sort of broad overview in mind, if you had to pick a part of your book which is sort of the core issue or the core problem that's driving the rest, what would you pick?
Well, this then came out largely from my previous work on the divorce industry, my previous book, and I began to see that this was a pattern, that what was going on, what I saw in the divorce system, was also something that was taking place elsewhere. We see on a daily basis accusations in the universities or in the military of various kinds of crimes that no one quite understands, sexual harassment, sexual assault, sexual abuse, and so forth. And I began to realize, I saw in the divorce system that innocent people were being accused and incarcerated through the judicial process in ways that they were completely helpless to avoid, innocent people, of things which were not necessarily crimes or which they had no control over. And I began to see that this was a pattern in other areas, that there were new creations of new crimes and new accusations or quasi-crimes or tort actions, various forms of legal wrongdoing, which were not the fault of the person being accused, but were the really creations of the state. And I saw innocent fathers, especially, and some mothers, being criminalized by the divorce industry and incarcerated, usually without any trial or due process of law. And it became very apparent when I started looking at false accusations of things like rape or sexual harassment or domestic violence, that these similar kinds of modus operandi were operating in these areas as well. So to answer your question, I think in many ways one of the striking things that I'm still convinced that the divorce system is in many ways the font, the kind of epicenter.
Yeah, and as I read your book, Stephen, I got the same sense. That's why in my review I focused on the no-fault, your treatment of no-fault divorce, which of course has become a completely accepted practice and really has not been questioned in any way by any loud voice in the culture. You're questioning it. Perhaps you could explain to our listeners why that is opened up this kind of Pandora's box.
Well, there's a number of reasons. I started to see this, especially with the controversy over same-sex marriage. And I came to realize that same-sex marriage, for reasons I argue in the book, really wouldn't exist as a controversy today if it weren't for the divorce system. In other words, it's the fact that we've already debased the institution of marriage through no-fault divorce, and it's no longer a binding legal contract. And by having debased it, we, the heterosexuals, have opened it up and made it attractive for the homosexuals to lay claim to it. In fact, I show quotations from homosexual activists, and they say, if you want to go back to the 1950s and monogamous marriage and a legal, binding legal contract in which fault is punished, go ahead. And if you do that, we will stay out of divorce. We will stay out of marriage. It's only because you, the heterosexuals, have debased marriage, adulterated it through divorce, adultery, cohabitation, and so forth, that it's attractive to most of us and to the promiscuous lifestyle that many homosexuals have. So I began to see that it really led straight to that, the real debasement of marriage. And other scholars were saying this too. People like Mike McManus have said that same-sex marriage is really not nearly as serious as divorce when it comes to debasing marriage as an institution. So that was one of the reasons I saw.
Well, let me sort of go further, because what I found convincing me in the way you laid this out was the way in which spouse being divorced, as it were, and it's usually the woman, say, divorcing the man, or the other way around, the person being accused becomes immediately a criminal, or treated as a criminal, though they have broken no criminal law. And they are immediately then placed under a kind of governmental overview or even control when it comes to child support and possible incarceration for non-payment. And so it was the treatment of the one being divorced that really opened my eyes to what you were saying.
Well, that's right. It is. Essentially, the divorced parent can be easily criminalized and incarcerated in ways that are powerless for
it. It has not committed a crime.
Any statute, exactly. And the judge actually has the power to legislate a kind of criminal, personalized criminal code around a divorced spouse that doesn't bind anyone else except that person. In other words, the judge legislates a criminal code around you, criminalizing behavior which anybody else can do legally, such as seeing your own children, for example, or going to certain places. If you do those things, it's a crime, or you can be arrested for it. You won't be tried. But anyone else can do those things.
But doesn't no fault explicitly state neither party is guilty?
Well, this is the great irony of the whole thing, is that it is the fault that was thrown out the front door comes in the back door, because after all, the whole purpose of a judiciary is to deal with justice. If there's no fault involved, then there's no justice. There's no fault justice is an oxymoron. It's a contradiction of terms. The judicial system is there to sort out injustices and to punish people. And if it doesn't dispense justice, it dispenses injustice. And that's what we have now. One of the striking things about my findings to me was the way the no fault divorce system is poisoning our entire judiciary. In other words, it's spreading out and undermining basic principles of the English common law and of due process of law in many other areas of the law aside from divorce. In other words, the things that you mentioned, the way that an innocent citizen can be criminalized in ways that he's powerless to control. I also saw this happening in areas like child abuse accusations.
Well, rape and sexual harassment.
Rape, sexual
and
harassment,
bullying,
all of these things.
Bullying. You list all of these.
All of these are kind of new crimes or semi-crimes that nobody quite understands. They blur the distinction between ordinary, impersonal, ordinary unsocial behavior or immoral behavior and criminality. So, for example, a university student who's accused of rape, there's very little chance that he will go to prison. So they say that this is not a judicial procedure. Instead, he's tried before a campus tribunal of professors and other students and administrators, and he risks the worst sanction is that he will be expelled from the university. But that's pretty serious. Actually, in some cases, the material, the evidence there, the procedure is then shared with the police, with the real police and the real justice system, and it can easily spill over into a real crime of rape. So it blurs the distinction here between a behavior that maybe some community doesn't approve of and a true crime. And this is happening again and again. Parents, for example, accused of child abuse, they don't usually go to jail, so that the courts claim that this doesn't require due process of law. But they can have their children taken away very easily. Well, for most parents, losing your children is far more serious than going to jail.
And you describe that process in the family courts as being something that is very subjectively decided by whoever happens to be sitting on the bench. And people have actually been kept by court order from sitting in and watching the deliberations of family court. Somehow this is all being done in a way that those doing it don't want to be accounted for.
That's correct, yes. And this is another example of how it is poisoning our standard judicial procedures. The Constitution talks about open trials, and yet family courts are often closed not only to the public and to the press, but they're even closed to some family members are not allowed in. And so this is another example of how the influence is spreading. We find this with the campus rape tribunals. We find this with a new institution known as domestic violence courts. They're not regular criminal courts. They deal only with domestic violence, and they are created for the express purpose of punishing more people and processing more accusations.
So, and all of this is encouraged by federal funding and federal support.
That's correct. It is.
And all those involved on the side of criminalizing and incarcerating and punishing have financial incentives to do so.
That's right. The federal government gives money to the courts through the child support system, which encourages more divorce. They give money to the social work, the child protective services, through the CAPTA, the Mondale Act. Federal money encourages states and social workers to find or to fabricate child abuse where it arguably doesn't exist. The universities receive money through Title IX. They receive federal funding, which gives them incentives to accuse students of rape or sexual assault.
How is that the case? What kind of money do they get for that?
Well, universities, most universities, not mine, by the way, but most...
Yeah, we'll talk about that in a minute.
Colleges and universities do receive large amounts of federal funding from the Department of Education and elsewhere.
You're not talking about specific programs. You're talking about a kind of generalized... feeling that they have to stay within the good wishes of the Department of Education?
Well, they do receive many kinds of, most universities receive many kinds of federal funding, various grants of many kinds. And if you've noticed, in many universities in recent years, they depend on this money for their building programs.
Absolutely.
Which expansion of universities into major businesses. But under Title IX, the federal government controls that funding. They have to adhere to certain standards.
Right.
If they are accused, for example, of discrimination, sexual discrimination,
right.
That money can be withheld. So the money, any federal funding in any form, gives the federal authorities great leverage over the universities, and they can control
right.
what they do.
Well, so if you don't get on the campus rape bandwagon, you might put yourself in jeopardy.
Precisely. Through the Title IX, which was an attempt to prohibit discrimination, sex discrimination in university programs, the interpretation of Title IX has so expanded from beyond simple what most people think of as discrimination into areas like accusations of rape and sexual assault. So that these things are said to be covered under Title IX, things which most people think of as crimes, which if they are committed or alleged to be committed, they should be handled by criminal authorities.
One thing that's very frightening to me in what you wrote, because I have a son who's just now entering college, is that the feminist ideology has created a perspective or even a policy, I should say, on handling rape allegations in which a woman's word is considered in itself enough to convict the so-called rapist, that the rapist has to prove somehow that he was had sex consensually, and as you say, even if he'd got in a notarized statement of consent, the woman could change her mind later on, and that notarized consent would become irrelevant.
Yes, the field of rape has become debased in a way that, again, serves as the model for many other changes that have taken place, but in ways that mean the word means something very different today, in legally speaking, than from what most people understand in plain English by that term. The legal authorities have continuously over the years been diluting the concept of rape to include instances where consent is involved, or were consent, as I should say, withdrawn later on. Again, this the cutting edge of this is in the universities, where the accusations are not necessarily formal criminal charges. They are accusations which take place within the rules of the university and are tried by university personnel.
And they don't try, as you put it, they don't try murder cases. Why should they be trying rape cases?
Well, precisely.
And you also point out from people who are involved in rape judicial matters, that up to 50% of all rape allegations are later shown to have been false allegations.
Yes, there's a number of testimonies I have there from prosecutors themselves, rape prosecutors in many cases, and other scholars. And there's been some very good work written recently by scholars and journalists on the rape accusations that take place in universities. There's a new book out by Stuart Taylor and Casey Johnson that I draw upon, and journalists like Kathy Young. So this is starting to get some attention, the rape accusations in universities. What's not getting attention are the larger rape accusations in the criminal courts, which are also oftentimes fabrications to an astounding
number. Now, in the criminal courts, are the men treated with the same kind of assumption of guilt as they are on the university campus?
It's not quite as bad as there, but it is quite clearly beyond what we would normally consider due process of law. This has been documented very clearly by Stuart Taylor and Casey Johnson in their book on the Duke rape accusations.
You use the Duke event and the University of Virginia event a few years later really to make a very solid case about a kind of hysteria that takes over on these campuses where the, like you said, 90-plus professors in Duke signed a letter basically condemning this young man, lacrosse player, of being guilty before he had any kind of chance to defend himself, and that the prosecutor had deliberately deliberately hidden proof that he was innocent the entire time he was pushing for a guilty verdict.
Yeah, it's quite scandalous. This is brought up very clearly in Taylor's book, and I share some other writers too. That's true. It is amazing. It vindicates James Madison's famous line about how, you know, if every Athenian citizen had been as brilliant as Socrates, Athens would still be a mob. And it's true. Even very well-educated people, like university professors and others, were basically, you know, conducting a witch hunt, a mob.
But they don't have to pay any price for that.
That's correct. They don't.
I mean, the prosecutor got disbarred, but that was it.
Yeah, that's right. And he was, at first, the first response of other prosecutors was to defend him. At first, they fell in line behind him and defended him, which to me is an admission that he didn't do really anything out of the ordinary. It was only later when they realized that he was going to be, you know, the sort of rats began jumping ship. Because it was clear that no one really faced any serious penalties in the Duke
case. Think Duke University or the University of Virginia learned any kind of lesson from this?
It doesn't appear so. No, apparently I'm told that I've read that the Duke reinstated the same kind of Title IX mandated measures as most other universities. So no, it doesn't seem like anything has been learned at all.
In fact, you quote some feminist scholars such as Andrea Dworkin and Catherine McKinnon saying that the actual guilt of the man involved isn't really relevant at all. That it's, in fact, you quote one person as saying, even if the man is guilty, it was a positive experience for him to be accused.
Even if he's innocent, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, this defies any notion of rational common sense that I've ever known.
Yeah. And the striking thing, too, is this is not limited to feminist ideologues. This is also being reflected in the legal system as well, and that's what's really scary.
But does this go back to the point you were making in your chapter about no-fault divorce, about the removal of the father? It's like there's a war on fatherhood, which has led to a war on men in general.
I think that's true. I think there has been a war against men to some extent, but especially toward fathers. And in many ways, that's the original sin. That's the first act which has brought so much of the family destruction in this country. Once you remove the father, then you've given the government an entree, a carte blanche, to basically enter the family and substitute for the father, substitute for the state becomes the provider, the state becomes the protector. Once the father is removed, then there's no real limit on how many social workers or judges or lawyers can move in and take control of the family, especially the children. So it's the first step. In divorce court, the first step is always the removal of the father. And then the burden of proof is on him to prove why he should get his children back. There's no burden of proof on the courts to justify why they removed the father in the first place.
And he is not guilty of real child abuse or real domestic violence. He's not guilty of any crime. Mm-hmm. His only crime, quote unquote, is that his wife wants to be free of him in the marriage and wants the children.
That's right. It's not necessary that he commit any legal infraction, either criminal or civil. As soon as she files for divorce, he is removed from the home immediately.
Does it work the other way around? What about the man that files for divorce?
Sometimes. Yes, it does. There are instances. Often if the man is connected with the legal system, if he's got an entree, if he's got connections with the legal system, then he can do it to her. Yeah.
And in the case of rape, I wanted to ask you this. Are there instances where in gay rape one man has accused another? I haven't seen any of those.
I haven't followed that. I haven't followed that trend yet. I suspect that we're coming up toward that. I have not pursued those. I hope the law is moving that way.
The real ideology that has transform culture, politics, and legal system is feminism. And, of course, this has been coming on now since the 60s. And we're now, over 50 years into the impact of feminism. And you point out that conservatives themselves have enabled sort of some of these feminist presuppositions to get their roots down deeper. The conservatives have not seen what they are really doing that is helping this to take hold.
That's right. One of the themes of the book is that this is what we're seeing here is an ideology, a sexual ideology similar to Marxism or communism, fascism, socialism, nationalism, but that it's based, the currency that it trades in is sexuality. And of course, the feminists were the vanguard of this. They started this, half a century ago or longer. And increasingly, it has been expanding in recent years to the homosexual activists, homosexualism, as I call it, and now transgender ideology. So it's expanding quite dramatically. And now that it's expanded into areas like homosexualism and transgenderism, conservatives and Christians are becoming involved, and they are becoming the targets of this. But what they fail to see oftentimes is that the roots of this go back deeper, and the roots go back into feminism of the 60s and 70s, and that they were the same techniques which they are now using against Christians and against others have been used for years, decades, against men, against fathers in particular. And if you really want to deal with this ideology, you've got to look at it as a whole. You can't just isolate homosexualism or same-sex marriage or the activism of the homosexual lobby. It's much larger. The homosexual aspect of it is really kind of the tip of the iceberg.
And we're going to come back and talk about what that larger enemy is. We'll be back with Dr. Stephen Baskerville talking about his new book, The Politics of Sex, right after this short break.
Hello, I'm Father John Esradi from Miles Christi Religious Order. I would like to invite you to join us for a gala on Friday, September 29th at the Lion Oaks Golf Club in Wixom. You'll have a chance to learn more about the mission of Miles Christi and hear a presentation by President and Chief Counsel of the Thomas More Law Center, Richard Thompson. Proceeds will help us continue our apostolic work in Southeast Michigan. To learn more, go to milleschristi.org/activities. That is milleschristi.org/activities.
It's that time again. The fall membership drive for Ave Maria Radio is September 11th through the 15th. And if you ever wondered what it's like to see it for your own eyes, you can volunteer to make this drive successful. If you can spare just a couple of hours during any of the days of the drive, that's September 11th through the 15th, you can give us a call right now, 877-288-1077, or email our volunteer director, Cheryl, to volunteer@AveMariaRadio.net.
It's time for Family Man with Dr. Gregory Popchuk.
You've heard it said that children are resilient, but it turns out that's not as true as we might like to think. A study in the journal Clinical Neuroimaging reports that children who experienced common family stressors like a lack of affection, marital problems, or poor communication experienced less development in the brain regions responsible for impulse control and stress regulation than did children who were raised in homes without similar stressors. The study is a wake-up call for moms and dads to attend to marriage and parenting struggles promptly. Currently, many couples wait 4 to 6 years before getting professional help. Knowing the effect that marriage and family stress has on our children's developing brains can hopefully encourage parents to get help sooner rather than later. To encourage good impulse control and stress management in our kids, the most important parenting technique is providing our children with a loving, affectionate, peaceful home life. I'm Dr. Greg Popchuk, but you can call me Family Man.
To discover more ways faith can enrich your life, visit CatholicCounselors.com.
Dr. Stephen Baskerville of the Patrick Henry College, professor of government there. We're talking about his brilliant new book. I really can't praise it too highly. Entitled The New Politics of Sex, The Sexual Revolution, Civil Liberties, and the Growth of Governmental Power, published by Angelico this year. And I urge all my listeners to buy this book and read it, mark it, let it be your guide to fighting these battles, whether you're fighting them at your child's school, or you're fighting them at the school board level, or even fighting them in the legislature, or even among your friends and neighbors. Steve Baskerville has given you the data, the arguments, and the facts that you need to cut through this very destructive nonsense about sexuality. Stephen, you describe almost what is a domino effect as you go through the book, you know, which at the end you go through all the different new kinds of crimes that have been defined, which are all based upon the subjective feelings of the person, usually the woman, who feels injured. Doesn't really matter whether or not anything happened, but if the woman feels it has happened, the man is guilty. But let's go back to the beginning. How would you describe this domino effect that brought us to this, to the absurdity that, for example, that someone has been sexually harassed if they just feel like they have been harassed?
Yeah, this is a very interesting phenomenon, and it's sometimes hard for people, the uninitiated, to really accept that things could be this extreme at this point. It's happened in a couple of ways. I mean, clearly, I don't want to say that this is not related to the breakdown of our traditional sexual morality in the first place. We've gone for several decades, increasingly free sexuality. Sexuality is a virtue for its own sake, sexual freedom without limits and purely for pleasure. And this is clear. I don't have to describe this. I think many people understand this in our society.
Just turn on the TV.
Yeah, exactly. The culture, and many people lament this. My argument is that it's gone a step further, that the state has now gotten involved in this. We've gotten to the point where the state is moving in, and sometimes under the guise, the rationalization of alleviating the oppressed, the state actually makes the problem worse. I mean, this is one of the striking things. The state claims that it comes in to relieve, for example, abused children. But my book shows very clearly that the state actually encourages abused children. It creates the very problem that it's supposed to be solving. And this is what most bureaucracies do.
Once you remove the father.
Once you remove the father, once you remove marriage, the two-parent family, you create the environment where child abuse is most likely, the single-parent home. And then you rationalize a whole panoply, a smorgasbord of all kinds of measures to take care of children, to watch out for child abuse, none of which work. None of which can possibly, if anything, they make the system worse, because you've created that original condition which encourages child abuse. That is to say, the broken home, the removal of the father, and this happens again and again. Each government measure that comes in ostensibly to relieve the oppressed or the abused or something creates another problem, which rationalizes more bureaucrats, more functionaries, more government power, more government spending, and the behemoth grows. Open-endedly, and the problem is never solved. The problem grows along with it. And this is what's striking. This is what we have to get out of this mindset, that the answer to all of this is more government power, more government functionaries, more government spending. If we step back and look at the origins of this, it's the government is the problem. The government is creating these problems. It's not to say that this is not to absolve all of us for our own, you know, fault in indulging in this, in the first place. But we need to think back about the solution to every problem may not be the government. The problem may be the government in the first place.
You know, you have a very poignant passage in which you describe the situation of a young black male in our culture. Often being the product of a single parent family, and therefore more likely to have been abused, going out into society and acting in a violent way, a way that he was treated in his home. And he thus becomes the victim of both sides, as it were. That's how you put it. You say, on the one hand, he is the victim of the single-parent family, and then when he commits a violent act, the conservatives all point their finger at the young man as an example of what the problem is in the black community.
Yes.
And the problem actually goes back much further.
That's right. Much of the problems we identify as being caused by race is in fact caused by this problem of the breakdown of sexual morality. And the young black male is the exemplar, the pawn in other people's games of power. That's right. He's the most likely to be the child of a single mother, to be fatherless in the first place, which makes him most vulnerable to becoming a criminal in the traditional sense of the word, because we know from numerous research that a fatherless home, a fatherless child, is the most vulnerable to becoming a criminal. But then on top of that, when he grows up and becomes a father himself, he's likely to become a father outside of wedlock, outside of marriage, he's also liable to being criminalized by the child abuse, the child support system, because he's likely not, his children are likely to be kept away from him if he's not married or even if he is in the first place. So then he, as a father, he's also criminalized as the as a non-payer of child support. So he's in a position where he's both liable to two sides of the problem, the real criminality, which is caused by the single-parent homes, and criminalization, which is caused by the governmental social work system. And it's not limited to young black low-income males anymore. This is spreading out to the middle-class society, all racial groups, ethnic groups, and all levels of income.
I want you to explain to our listeners something that I did not know, which came as a complete shock to me, and that is that state governments actually receive funding from the federal government based upon all the dollars they collect for child support. In other words, they are incentivized to be partners with divorce courts and family courts in the punishment of the male into child support payments.
Yes, this is absolutely diabolical. It's complicated to understand, but it is. I would urge your readers to take a look at the book and get the full horror of what's going on in the child support system. The child support system was created to ostensibly to force men who had abandoned their offspring to take financial responsibility for the children that they had sired and then abandoned. This makes sense. Everyone goes along with this. Nobody would deny the need for this where it happens. But instead, it's been perverted into a system which actually creates fatherless homes and forces fathers away from their children. In other words, fathers who are perfectly willing to raise their children, support their children, give moral and parental guidance to their children, they're forcibly separated from their children so that the state can collect child support. In other words, the state collects child support. They get, oftentimes they can use the child support to fill their own coffers if the mother is getting welfare money. It simply reimburses them. It doesn't go to the children. It goes to the state. They also can collect federal money from each child support dollar they collect. And this gives, again, it's complicated, but the bottom line is it gives the state governments a financial incentive to create as much divorce and as many single-parent homes and as many fatherless children as possible. This sounds horrible, but it is the absolute and undeniable truth. The states have a financial incentive in encouraging broken homes, divorce, single-parent homes, criminality among children, adolescents.
And incarceration of fathers who failed to pay.
Exactly. And they get federal money for all of this. Every taxpayer in America is subsidizing single-parent homes and the problems that go along with it.
I bet nobody knows that who's listening to this program. I didn't know it, and I'm still shocked by it. You say this program started in the Clinton era?
It gradually developed during the 80s of all times, under the radar screen, but it really emerged in the open during the with the Clinton administration. It began to snowball, so that the perverse incentives became a way of encouraging mothers to divorce with financial incentives, of encouraging states to encourage mothers to divorce. All of this really took off in the 90s.
Do you happen to know what amounts go to the state? What magnitude of payments are made by the federal government?
I don't have the latest figures. My previous book, Taken into Custody, has some of those. They're about 10 years old now, but it's quite a lot of money. It allows the states to balance their books. Well, a few years ago, in California, the then Governor Gray Davis was urged to sign a bill that would include divorce reform so that parents could care for their children equally. And he openly stated that the reason that he wouldn't sign the bill was that California could not afford to forego the federal payments for child support.
Did he say that?
He said this openly. In other words, the states use this money to balance their budget. They can use it for any purpose they want. They can take this money from child support enforcement.
So they don't have to put it into welfare, which was originally meant to support.
That's right. In other words, the state governments are expanding their finances and they're expanding their power by proliferating single-parent homes and fatherless children. It is astounding. But the government has created a perpetual growth machine. It can indefinitely, open-endedly expand its power and its spending and its reach by creating as many single-parent homes as possible.
Your book is an obvious place where people can begin to fight back by at least understanding the root causes of it, the way in which economics and government power drive it, the way in which ideology, in a way it elicited it and continues to feed it. Is there any way to actually begin to reverse this domino effect that we're dealing with?
I think public information is the first step. I think people need to understand how shocking this is. And it's on the news every night. I mean, some aspect of this, whether it's the breakdown.
Well, not your version of it.
Not my version, no. I mean, the manifestations of this problem were on the news every night.
Yeah.
But the scholars and the journalists don't want to face it. And sadly, this includes even the conservative scholars and the Christian scholars. I don't find taking on these issues. There's a fear about this. They've created a stigma. Who wants to defend a man accused of campus rape or parents accused of child abuse? Or, I mean, these are all labeled as sex crimes and sexual abuse of children, rape of women, beating of violence against women, fathers who abandon their children. I mean, these are stigmatized, and people are terrified to be put themselves in a position of being accused where they can be accused of defending these kind of ogres. So they run away from this. They run away from these obvious injustices and these obvious untruths. And and this includes the scholars and the journalists and those who we look to as being the leaders for controlling and the watchdogs of our society, the abuse of government power. So that's where it has to start, I think. It has to start with the scholars, the journalists, the intellectuals, the university professors, the church. I think she has an obvious role. All the churches have an obvious role in this is all a vindication of traditional Christian sexual morality. If we hadn't departed from that, this problem wouldn't have arisen in the first place. It's our retreat from traditional sexual morality that creates the void, which allows the government to move in and fill up the space and take control. So the churches, the universities, the journalists, these are the people that need to be more outspoken and more energetic in investigating this, because I think once they do, they'll find a huge body of abuses and scandals to be publicizing. They're just frightened to do it.
Well, you could only write this book, as you say in the book, because you're at a university that doesn't rely on federal dollars.
I think that's largely true. I'm very blessed in that respect. My university does not depend on federal money that can be withdrawn. It's not to say that they haven't tried to put pressure on us, too. There was a new Republic article about my college several years ago, which implied, without any proof, that there were rapes and sexual assaults on campus. There's no evidence that this, in fact...
By the way, I sent a note to your college president about how great your book was.
Oh, well, thank you very much.
I was chairman of the board of an accrediting agency that accredited Patrick Henry many years ago.
And
I think it's a wonderful place. And your book is a great proof of it. Sometimes it's the details in your book that are the most convincing of how bad the situation is. For example, you talk about the way in which DNA evidence has actually been falsified deliberately in the labs or lost deliberately in order to make sure the man is convicted of rape.
This is quite astounding, yes. Even this has come out even in places like the Washington Post and other liberal outlets have publicized this, although they've invariably spun it in such a way as to make it appear like a, you know, a case of mistaken identity or overwork or something like that. But this is quite clearly not the case. The Innocence Project is another one. The legal groups and law school students who work to expose false convictions of innocent people. Their cases are overwhelmingly rape cases. And yet, where their work is admirable, they seem frightened, they seem diffident about pointing this out, that these are mostly sexual cases. So clearly, there's a pattern here. There's a pattern of this behavior that's developing. I think that sexuality is on the vanguard of this. I mean, I think conservatives and others, there's a lot of talk nowadays about race, about white supremacy, and about racial tension, and about multiculturalism, and that sort of thing. But clearly, the vanguard of radical politics today is not race, and it's not sex, and it's not economics, it's not socialism or communism or fascism or nationalism, it's sexuality. That's the vanguard of left-wing politics today, and nobody seems to want to look at it. Nobody seems to want to.
Well, that may explain why you use the word hysteria so much to describe what happened, for example, at Duke or at the University of Virginia, or what's happened in the writings of radical feminists, where they say that guilt doesn't matter, where they say that a woman's word should be treated as enough for a conviction, that the accused has no really basis to offer counter evidence, no due process. Because sexuality, it drives something very deep within all of us, and something that is tied very much to desire, to excess in many different directions. So it would explain why so much of the behavior and so much of the language is, in fact, hysterical.
Yes, that's precisely right.
Freud would understand.
Yes. One could get into explanations like that. It was a pattern that I began to see in these areas, not only rape, but sexual harassment, domestic violence, stalking, child abuse, bullying. This pattern kept emerging in all these different areas, and they all had one thing in common. They all involved some kind of sexual accusation. And we've seen this, you know, in different ways. Even something like, you know, we hear about lynching, for example, all the time. But lynching was originally a crime of almost invariably linked to accusations of rape. We see it as a racial.
You talked about white women who made false accusations of rape toward black men and ended up in there being killed.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. So in many ways, what's happened?
Yet the feminists defend that.
Yeah, yeah, and the races have changed. Now we have black women making accusations against white men, and the other way around. Both. So the races have changed in some ways, but the genders, of course, the sexes remain the same. And so yes, it is. Oftentimes there are optical illusions like this in history, which if we begin to start looking at them differently, we see they may have causes that we didn't realize.
What happens when a man accuses a woman of rape on a college campus?
I don't recall too many cases of that offhand.
Wouldn't the same logic, of course it's not really logic, but wouldn't the same logic work in a reverse case, that if a man accuses a woman of rape, then his word should be treated as enough for a conviction?
Well, these kind of things are starting to happen. There's literature on that subject, on the rape of men by women. And there's also, the laws, of course, are gender neutral. So they are, in theory, it should work that way. What's happening more likely, and this is quite striking as well, is that on the one hand, the universities, the women accuse the men, and then the universities, you know, try the men in these kind of kangaroo courts. But then what the men are doing they're retaliating with lawsuits of their own, sometimes under the same Title IX discrimination statute that they're being accused under. So the Title IX, so instead of just not accusing the men in the first place, first they accuse the men, one group of lawyers accuses the men of rape, and then another group of lawyers gets to come back and sue the university on behalf of the men. So the Title IX and these federal statutes create a kind of bonanza for lawyers, a kind of bonanza of suits and countersuits, where at the end of the day, kind of like the Sneetches, if you know the Dr. Seuss story, the lawyers walk away with everything. The litigants are impoverished, and the universities, of course, are impoverished.
Well, it drives up the cost of attending a university.
Absolutely. Certainly does. Yes. So instead,
I can only imagine what universities have to keep in their budget for legal services.
Well, this has been argued. I forget who it is that says this. I think I quoted in my book somewhere. One authority on this says that basically most college presidents in this country are front men for the what's known as the Office of Legal Services or some name like that. Every university has its own.
Well, just like many of the bishops in the Catholic Church, by the way.
Yeah, they have their own. Every university has its own in-house law firm who make the real decisions. Every decision of the university has to be cleared because the main criterion for any decision in the university is what will prevent us from being sued by somebody.
You talk about a situation. Yeah. I was familiar when the president of Harvard had to step down for some comment he made that offended the feminists. But you also talk about a British scientist who was an arch liberal who made an offhanded comment at a cocktail party and ended up being thrown out of the Royal Society and stripped of all his honors.
Yeah.
Who was that?
Yes, this was a physicist for a private remark. And it's starting to be, this is starting to happen more and more. There was a case of a sportscaster similarly who made
when you do it on air, it's another thing, isn't it?
Right. Well, the sportscaster, I think, did it privately as well. He didn't.
Oh, really?
The phone was on. It was a private conversation that was somehow got broadcast on the microphone.
Now you can have things tweeted and you can have things videoed. And
but this is something I think an impoverishment of our political culture because originally we made a distinction between things you say in public and things you say in a professional capacity, on the one hand, and things you say in a private conversation. But nowadays you can be hauled up on you can lose your job, of course, obviously, or you can be hauled up on various kinds of torts or even quasi-criminal charges for words that are spoken privately. Tim Hunt.
How is it even possible to be a college professor at any other place other than Patrick Henry these days?
Well, I imagine it's very difficult, and this is why I think we see a lot of weasel words come out of universities, and not just the presidents, but the scholars as well. We used to see this. This is very familiar to me, at least from the period of communism. The communist totalitarian rule creates weasels, as we say, government. Weasel words. People who try to, as Orwell said, who have to defend the indefensible, and come up with various kinds of euphemisms and weasel words in order to defend things which not long ago we would have thought of as being indefensible.
Well, you also quote Saint-Just, one of the French Jacobins, saying no freedom except for, finish that quote for me.
No freedom for the enemies of freedom. Is the original.
Right. In other words, no freedom for those who disagree with us.
Precisely. And that's kind of the anomaly we have. It is quite an anomaly that, this push for unlimited, open-ended sexual freedom creates authoritarianism.
And this, but it's an authoritarianism of the mind. It's you're pressured into groupthink, and you're pressured into harming people and isolating people and destroying people by placing them under a group name, right?
Very, very much so, yes.
Racist, like they're trying to do to President Trump right now, or what would be the other group names that are becoming so, are being used to hurt people and to basically destroy their lives?
Well, the original ones, of course, the ones started by the feminists, were things like batterer, rapist, deadbeat dad.
Sexual harasser.
Harasser, that kind of thing, abuser, pedophile.
Child abuser, wife abuser.
And pedophile, of course.
Misogynist.
Increasingly, though, the homosexualist lobby has taken over the similar techniques, and they've used
homophobic.
Homophobic, bigoted, hater. Everyone who disagrees with a certain...
Alt-right.
Alt-right, yeah.
I still don't know what that means.
Hate crimes, hate speech, and so forth. So the techniques that the feminists pioneered against fathers and against men are now being expanded by the homosexualists and others against Christians and against other other conservatives. So it's a good example of a famous line from Pastor Niemöller during the Second World War, the Lutheran pastor.
Yes.
Said that first they came for the socialists and the Jews and everything, and I didn't defend them. So and then they came for me, and there was no one to defend me. So we need to see this in its totality. We need to see it as an ideology which extends in many ways to many people who have a lot in common, And I object because, you know, many Christians and conservatives and liberals and libertarians, they want to defend themselves and their constituency against certain aspects of this problem, but they don't want to defend others against what they're being accused of. And this is divide and rule.
Well, Dr. Stephen Baskerville, you have issued a clarion call to all of us, and I strongly recommend to our listeners to get a copy of your book, The New Politics of Sex, Sexual Revolution, Civil Liberties, and the Growth of Governmental Power. It's really a very, very important book, and one that I think will lead to a lot of good for a lot of people and for our culture. So thank you for being on Church and Culture today.
It's my pleasure. Thank you very much.
Look forward to having you back sometime in the near future.
I would love that. God bless you.
And to all of you who are listening, we'll have a short break and have another great guest afterward.
Father Edward Perone preached a homily at the Assumption Grotto during the Feast of the Assumption Mass.
And it was for man that the Incarnation was decreed. Mary, then, was the chosen instrument of God through which this was going to take place. She, then, was first in God's intention to fulfill these purposes. If the world was made for man and man for God's Incarnation, then Mary has to be the high point of the whole visible creation.
This is Henry Root, your host for Putting On the Mind of Christ. We broadcast the Feast of the Assumption Mass from the Grotto at the Assumption Grotto Church. We'll hear Father Perone's homily, and we'll hear Marcus Rodi's biblical defense of the Catholic Church as we finish our coverage of the Last Call to Holiness Conference. Listen to Putting On the Mind of Christ this Sunday afternoon at 3, encoring Saturday afternoons at 6 on 990 WDEO, 1440 WMAX, and AveMariaRadio.net on the Internet.
We know that young children thrive when they have ample time to play. But is it really as easy as telling your child to go outside? Today on Homeschool Heartbeat, join Dr. Nancy Carlson Page to explore how you can give your child the tools to develop a healthy sense of play.
Nancy, last time we talked about three main developmental needs that children have: creative play, security, and positive relationships. What are the most effective ways for parents to nurture creative play in their children?
I'm so glad you're asking this question about creative play. It is truly the primary vehicle through which children relate to the world in the early years. And unfortunately, we're seeing a diminishing of play in children's lives these days. And it's such an extremely important aspect because children, through play, they're actually making sense of the world around them. So it builds emotional equilibrium and a sense of inner security and inner resilience. But play is also vital to cognitive development, like self-regulation and problem-solving and imagination through play. So parents can do a great deal to foster healthy creative play, creating a time and place for it to happen, having materials available that are open-ended. And what I mean by that is materials children can use in their own ways and that foster creative play, and then the time and space for it to happen are crucial things we parents can do.
Those are wonderful ideas, Nancy. And listeners, thanks for tuning in. I'm Diane Coomer, and I'm cheering you on.
Today's program was part of a longer interview. If you'd like to hear the whole thing, you can find it on our website at homeschoolheartbeat.com. That's homeschoolheartbeat.com.
This is Father Frank Pavone of Priests for Life. When people ask me about the right to die, I say, don't worry, you won't miss out on it. A right is a moral claim. But we do not have a claim on death. Rather, death has a claim on us. And when it draws near to our brothers and sisters, it is our duty to surround them with all the love and care we can, and to remind them that no matter how frail they become, they are always children of God whose lives are valuable beyond measure. Some in our society are using language about the right to die to disguise a right to kill, to get the burdensome and inconvenient out.